That's a song that changed my life. In the 1980s, when I lived in Kingston, studied Queen's University, I walked by folks like that all the time. And I also like Phil Collins. That song haunts me. 20 years ago, I was walking the streets of Edinburgh on Sunday nights because my daughter went to a young people's meeting at Charlotte Baptist Chapel, and I didn't belong there. And I had to see her back home on the bus. Bus 44 took us back to Musselburgh. So for 3 hours, I had nothing to do in Edinburgh. In Edinburgh, on Sunday night, they roll up the carpets, they turn off all the lights. It's a truly Scottish city. Nothing worth mentioning happens in the restaurants. There are no coffee shops. The place just shuts up at 6 o'clock at night, and everybody goes inside to, I don't know, weep about their sins or whatever. But Edinburgh is a dead place. So I walk the streets. There's only one store open, the Pornography Bookstore on Prince's Street. So I avoid that, and I keep walking back and forth and around, and I got to see Edinburgh after dark. 600 or more people sleeping rough. If you're British, you know what that means. I went into a BUPA, private hospital site, surrounded by hedges, and I saw a line of cardboard boxes like you'd have appliances in originally. Probably about 100 people sleeping rough in cardboard boxes. Because you can do that in Edinburgh. You only get snow and freezing rain maybe once or twice a year, and then because they only have two snow plows, it's demolition derby on the streets. But sun comes out, stuff melts. It's a pretty temperate climate. You go along the hedges down by the mound. You walk up those long steps up to the old town, to the high street, and under the hedges are the roll of bedrolls of the people who sleep rough by night and who beg by day. Some of them have dogs. And of course, because, as you know, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals is much better organized and far more ferocious than the police force. You may be rough, but you don't abuse your animal in Britain, because the humanitarians will have your guts for garters. Those animals are well, they've got all their shots, they've got all their tags, they've got the water dish. The person looks like they've come through a bombing. But the dog is well-groomed. Now, some of them are professionals. I actually ran into one changing clothes in his locker down in Waverley Station after a day of begging. I gave one look at him, and he gave one look at me, and I said, I got you figured out. But there's a lot of others who aren't faking. And on Sunday nights, about 8:30 to 10:30, the little vans come rolling along the side streets to the closes, which is what they call the alleys in Edinburgh. And the light of the back comes on when they flip up the railing, and you see reflected in the glow on the side a name of a church or a name of a charity. And then slowly, like ghosts coming out of the grave, wrapped in their woolen blankets, come these people with blankets over their head in the fog and the mist. And they take little shuffling steps forward, and they get their cup of soup, and they get their toothpaste, and maybe a sanitary napkin, or their tissues, or maybe a pair of socks, or coffee or tea, it's Britain after all, and then they shuffle off out of the light, back into the gloom. Here's a story from the Gospel of Luke. Jesus tells stories. Here's one for you. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. Time came when the beggar died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to them, Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue because I'm in agony in this fire. But Abraham replied, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you're in agony. And besides this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you can't, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." And he answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, then they will repent." Abraham replied, "If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets now, they'll not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." That's a parable. You can tell it's a parable because people are in it. If it's animals, it's a fable. If it's just rules laid out, it's a sermon. But if it's a story with people in it, it's a parable. Now, Jesus tells a lot of parables, right? In fact, you could actually write a musical about him called The Storytelling Man, because that's what he is. This is a parable. And as a parable goes, it's got some interesting stuff going on that I want to talk about tonight and share what the Bible says and ask ourselves what it really means for us today. Because if it's just a story Jesus told, well, that's nice. Goes into our trivial pursuit file. But if it's a story Jesus told, it's the King talking. Creator of the universe, seated at the right hand of God the Father, who loves us and knows us. And this is not an accident that we're here tonight to read this all together. Because I don't believe in accidents. I've lived too long to believe in accidents. See, Jesus has just talked earlier about the prodigal son. We all know about the prodigal son, right? Like my little brother took off, had a great time, came back broke, sick, and broken. And my dad went out, loved him to death, and I sat back there and said, "You idiot." Actually not, but there were moments when I felt like that a bit with my little brother. God help me. But then I always was the older brother that did everything by the book. Sickening, isn't it? And I paid for that ever since. See, it's interesting. You see, here, think about this. Lazarus, who is he? He's kind of like Job. You know, the thing about the Bible is one story leads you to think of other stories. They're kind of all connected, right? It's almost like one God wrote it all. Lazarus is a kind of Job. Right? Remember Job in the Old Testament, one of the oldest stories in the Bible. He's there, he's doing everything right. God loves him, he loves God. He's so careful, he even sacrifices for his sons and daughters' sins, which they might or might not have committed. They're party animals, they are. And then they're all taken. Raiders, disasters, earthquakes, and they're all dead. And his wife says, oh, I forgot, he gets sick too. Boils, sores all over his body. He's rotting in his own flesh. And his wife says, I can't take this anymore. Curse God, would you mind and get it over with so that God will zip you out? You know how God has his sort of toxic reaction to evil? It's kind of like a violent exothermic reaction. The Bible says fire bursts forth. Yeah, well, you watch calcium on water and you know what you get. I always thought, or the sound of a bug getting on a bug getter. You know, that's about our modern equivalent to God's reaction to evil. It's toxic. He has a violent reaction, and it's not anaphylactic. So, Job's wife can't take it. She says, off yourself so I can live, and she leaves. In fact, Job is alone for the rest of the passage with a bunch of friends that are trying to help him by convincing him he didn't confess on some sin, which is no help at all. With friends like that, who needs enemies? The Holy Righteousness Brigade comes in to explain God to him. Well, that's kind of like Lazarus. He's sitting on the street. Alone. Alone. He maybe had a family once. He maybe had fame and fortune. Maybe he had an education. Maybe he had status. Maybe he even wore purple and then he got leprosy. Leprosy is unforgivable. Remember, New Testament leprosy is a bit different from the leprosy we think of with parts of your body falling off and everything else. It's more like general skin diseases, but they were feared because they were contagious. So he lives alone on the street with nothing. Oh, except he's got friends, the dogs. Now, there are no cats in the Bible. Not sure why, probably because they're Egyptian origin and therefore idols. There's a goddess called Bastis from Egypt. So to have a cat story might be tempting to idolatry. So cats are banned from the Bible. I don't know. Dogs, on the other hand, are there, but they're not respected. Find me a good reference to a dog in the Bible, and I'll be surprised. Dogs are treated like Lazarus. And they find each other on the street. Now, I was just talking to Joanne again about this, because I don't know if it's true or not. I've been told that dog spit and dog licking is good for healing sores and so on. And dogs, of course, will eat anything. Let me tell you, I've seen it. But of course, the point is that these dogs are his only friends. It's as if God sent him the only critter that cares, that can make him part of their pack. And they love him. They keep him warm at night. They cuddle up with him. He has nothing to give them. Nothing but love. And they love him back. Not that he gets any credit for it on the street. And then he dies. And there's somebody else in the story who doesn't even have a name. And I find that interesting. Why doesn't the rich man have a name? In the Middle Ages, they gave him a name. They called him Dives, which is Latin for rich. But really, we don't know what his name is, which I think is interesting. Because that guy wears purple and linen. In other words, he's wearing the best. He's got the $700 shark suit. He's got the lifestyle and the power. In fact, in Jesus' time, if you wore purple and linen and lived like that, you were a Sadducee, which meant you had noble blood. I'm descended from King David's brothers. Fear me. And money and power, and you ran the temple. It was your business, the business of being the high priest. In fact, we know that the high priest Caiaphas had a son named Annas who had five boys. Five brothers. You can't get much closer to a headshot from Jesus than that, can you? But no name. But everyone knows what he's talking about. Someone who should be able to call on God for anything, someone who should have all the privileges, who everything goes right for, and who doesn't even notice Lazarus. There is no human contact between them. Lazarus lives outside on the street, outside the gate. Rich man doesn't even notice it. There's no connection whatsoever. He's living it up. In fact, the Greek says he's living noisily with his food and his parties. It's actually neighborhood known, notorious, the kind of high living this rich guy has. And then he croaks. And then the great reversal comes. Flip. How many remember the old song, Rock on My Soul in the Bosom of Abraham? Camp song, really? Yeah. We're not going to sing it, okay? It means nothing. So high, we can't. What is that? So what? You know, so low. It's something that, you know, when you're guys, you can do the actions and bash your friends in the face while you're doing, like, wide is the ocean. And it's a corny song. And the problem is, it doesn't mean anything. But in the King James, it says that Lazarus is in the bosom of Abraham, which I think is a very uncomfortable place to be, honestly. But what it means, of course, is it's Bible code for being at his table, in his fellowship, in his family. Lazarus, which, by the way, comes from the Hebrew God has helped, is literally a kid adopted into Abraham's personal household and sits next to Isaac and dwells next to the founder of the holy people of God. Meanwhile, rich man's gone to Lethbridge. Or no, he's gone to hell. Further south, even than Lethbridge. You know, maybe Tabor or Cardston or who knows. But you see, he's down, you can't get much lower than the rich man. And he is alone. And he's not changed by the experience. He's a rich man looking for staff, even in hell. Because he says, get Lazarus to come here, Abraham. As if Abraham's going to order Lazarus. Here, Lazarus, would you mind? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know. By the way, did you notice Lazarus doesn't say a thing? Perfectly silent. It's remarkable. Humility. Knowing his place. But also dwelling in the light of the God who perhaps was silent during his earthly life, but who he loved. Because Lazarus has a kind of faith that, unlike Job's wife, Lazarus never curses God for his tough times. Are there dogs in heaven? There's a cartoon that says there are. But I don't know. I mean, seriously, it doesn't matter. Because what this is all about is the symbolism of his position next to Abraham at the table. Can you get any closer to being right with God than being in Abraham's personal family? Wow. There are probably no Scotsmen in Abraham's personal family. One of the lesser brothers, you know. But of course, the point is, the rich man, you can't get any further away from God than where he is. And he's still looking for staff to do work. And he wants to dip a drop of water from Abraham to cool his tongue. And Abraham says, with apologies to Larry Norman, there's no time to change your mind. How could you have been so blind and deaf? Because there's a gulf and nothing can cross that gulf. You can't go back. There is no second chance. You lived your life oblivious to hurting people, and now there's nothing any of us can do about it. Least of all you. And you think you want to help your five brothers. Well, wonderful. So you like your clan. You're loyal to your family. Rich people are often loyal to their family, right? Family first. Well, there's no staff for that either. Because your family has the same problem you have. And that's the point of the story. What happened to make this guy's heart so hard and his eyes so blind? And the answer is, wealth. Because you see, there's a problem with wealth. It comes with baggage. It comes with work. It comes with worry. You think wealthy people have nothing to do? Let me tell you, they're preoccupied with getting more money, working out their plans, managing their crazy family, doing crazy things, you know, also scheming for privileges. They're like the rich and powerful. Who am I having dinner with? Who can I influence here? Who can I buy there? Who can I crush there? How do I manage? And there's only two words all men are born with. Women too, maybe, but men for sure. One is more, and the other is again. Right? Women know that about men. And that's the point. This man lives his life obsessed with more. He is a fool. In the sense that he doesn't know what matters. But it distracts him from what does. And wealth does that. It preoccupies you. It makes you busy. So many people I know up here, they got their nose on the grindstone. We used to joke about people having their nose at the grindstone because it works so hard. I see people up here who are deformed from obsession with work and money. They're deformed by it. Who's God? I keep busy. They can't even retire because they're afraid they might lose something or miss something. What are they living for? I don't know. I've never yet met an RV worth driving, even one that can talk. I've never met the stuff that people are obsessed by. And I lived in Ottawa. I've known people. I have good friends who work for the Prime Minister. I've met the Chief of Defense Staff, and it's not worth it to be in their circles. There is no peace there. It is all crafty scheming plots and doing. It's like soap opera, only it's politics, which makes it even more sickening. And in the end, you come away from the Ottawa bubble and everybody says there's two things wrong with government. One is it's corrupt and the other it's ineffective. Which is like being rich. Corrupt and ineffective. And Jesus knows that. He says the real point here is, it's at the end of the story, isn't it? By the way, why does he call this guy Lazarus? Because there is another Lazarus, isn't there? Lives in Bethany, has two awesome sisters, Mary and Martha. Good people. They always have a room for Jesus. Mary likes to listen to Jesus, maybe a little too much. Leaves Martha with all the housework. You know the story. Martha says, Lord, would you tell Mary to get off her backside? Sorry. It's my name. What can I say? Yeah, and do something. You know. And Jesus says, Mary, you're distracted from what matters. Because Jesus knows that his biggest problem with many of his religious people is they're distracted by the wrong things. So come and sit down, Martha, and do what Mary's doing. And listen to me. And here, Abraham's point is this. When you're distracted your whole life, and you can't even see the dying beggar in front of you, you have missed it. You have missed it forever. And all the regret in the world won't matter. Because he said, you should laugh with those who laugh, and mourn with those who mourn, and rejoice with those who rejoice, and suffer with those who suffer. You know, people these days say there's too much empathy out there. I'll tell you what Jesus would say. Maybe it's misplaced, but there's not enough. Because this empathy has to have actions. And he doesn't even see Lazarus. Maybe because Lazarus is covered with dogs. I don't know. We can go with the slide now, right? These are the church's pictures of Lazarus over the centuries. This is one from the early church. And of course, the punchline is at the bottom, you know, like all good graphic novels. We have another one coming up in a few seconds. I want you to kind of look at them. I tell the kids when they see this, check out the dogs, you know. Get to know them. There's Lazarus. They didn't even have clothes on. Those are rather Roman-looking dogs, pretty much short-skinned. Nasty looking fellas. As we get more sentimental in life, the dogs get nicer in the pictures. They get closer to our time. This is the Renaissance. Rich Renaissance Italian family having their meal out in the courtyard, and Lazarus is out of it. Reformation time. Good German, right? Von Lazarus und der reichen Mannen. Under the table, literally. Covered in sores. Remember, this is the period of medieval leprosy, the worst kind. And of course, Dutch. Gotta love those Dutch. 17th century, the richest nation on earth, having the richest bank. You can barely even see him. He's in the far back corner at the back door. Almost covered up. While everyone else, look at the rosy cheeks and plump, you know. It's a real Vermeer. British 19th century, the beggar, can't even get a job. Rich man. Don't bother me. You can tell it's Victorian because the dogs are much nicer, right? But again, now he's at the center, but his only friends have four paws. And we never know their names either. I saw a man like that in Kingston, down by the ferry to Wolf Island in 1985. Can you imagine? The summer of 1985, someone like that. Oh, Barbie and Ken. And Ali, or maybe Jose, who God has helped. Notice the dogs have collars. Russian, nice paraphilite style, you know, kind of artistic. The dog is pretty lean and mean. You can't get more alone than that when you die. You could see that scene any day in a Middle Eastern city today. Cairo, Damascus, any day. By the way, the dogs are a little scruffier because they know dogs aren't loved. And finally, Look up in the corner. Hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil. He doesn't even have dogs, he just has apes. Or is it some of us? Jesus tells stories and pictures. Where are we in the picture? Because he says, if you're not paying attention to this, you're not a child of mine. You're not a child of God. You're missing it. And you will be surprised at the consequences. I won't tell you what to do with this story. It's not how it works. Parables are like litmus tests, you know? Or like when you're sitting on the toilet and the thing turns blue. Oh, this is what I really am. Yeah, that's what a parable tells you. When your heart moves at this story, it's already telling you who you are. And Jesus does that to those people at that time and says, you have ears, you hear this story, and what your heart says to this story tells you what you have to do. And it might be, get on your knees. By the way, when you do that, Jesus is quite happy to meet you there. He will reach out and pull the beard off someone who wants to find fault with God. And he will say, you want to fight with God? You want to spit on me? You want to take me on? You want to fight for a religious system that's sick? All right, put up your dukes. But to someone who really is hurting, who is really confused, or who really wants to know, he will get on his knees to help. I know I've been there. And that's what I want you to think about. That's what this parable's saying. Who are you? Oh, by the way, however you are, Jesus says, I'm here to help. He says, I'm here to love you. I'm here to die for you. I'm here to give you more than you could ever know. Life! And if you're distracted, pay attention. Pay attention. C.S. Lewis wrote, God whispers in our pleasures and shouts in our pains. I know, my life. He's taught me more when I was so depressed I could barely work, when I wasn't going to graduate, when my dreams were dying. When my students were dying, when nothing made sense. He was closer then than sometimes he feels now when things are moving along fairly well and I can pay my bills most of the time and stuff, you know? It's almost scary. But I promise you, you pray an honest prayer, you'll get an honest answer. You pray an eager prayer, a helpless prayer, an honest prayer. Jesus will do phenomenal things with your honesty. He will. I testify to that myself. And that's what this story is about. There's some good questions here, you know. Who is the true Israel? It's Lazarus, lying in the street with dogs for his friends. That's the true Israel. Not the Israel of the purple, of the religious system, of the powerful, of the rich, that's so busy it doesn't even know which end is up. But thinks it is. Why does Jesus name Lazarus? Because he's going to raise a Lazarus from the dead, and he knows it. That Lazarus in Bethany will be brought back from the dead, 4 days dead. Everybody knows when that grave opens, it's going to stink. But you know something? It doesn't, which is amazing. When Lazarus comes out of that tomb, there's nobody holding their nose. But Jesus is weeping because he knows what it means. I'm going to give you the ultimate miracle and you'll reject me anyway. It's his last great miracle. He raises Lazarus from the dead and the same people that are going, wow, will be shouting, crucify him a week later. You see, people say, if God gave me a sign, well, actually, if he did, you might not get it. You might find fault with it. You might criticize it. You might finally decide, that's it. I'm done. This religious stuff is no good. Sometimes what God just wants you to do is pay attention to what he's already written. and apply it. Because you see, Jesus knows, I'm going to give you that sign. I'm even going to do it with somebody named Lazarus. And you're not going to get it. Unless you have eyes to see and ears to hear. And then everything else will come. See, it's not wealth that's the problem. It's distractedness. It's preoccupation. It's busyness with this stuff that we have now that leads to a hard heart. You know, there was a great pope, Innocent III. Started off fairly well. He was going to fix the church. And Bernard of Clairvaux, who was a monk who preached so brilliantly that people used to say, don't let Bernard preach in your church, or all the men will join the priesthood. Wives, lay on to your husbands. Fine, take them fishing on that Sunday when Bernard comes, because you won't have them when he's done. Because he had this amazing power to persuade. And Bernard said to Innocent, you guard against one thing, the busyness that causes a hard heart. And you know, Innocent failed to do that. He did not guard his heart. He went on to save the papacy, all right. And we never want to call anyone innocent today. Has not been many popes named Innocent since him. He was a fearful pope. Did some great things. But he got busy. And he lost his heart. And that's the threat. Jesus knows. It's what's going to kill him. He's going to go to his friends, and they're going to cross him up. Because they're not his friends, even though they say they're God's friends. So there it is. You know, we live in a country which does not bad compared to other countries. Britain, which invented social welfare, still has people that I used to know, used to walk among on those Sunday nights in the mist and the fog, who became like ghosts that nobody noticed in the daytime, or who were beggars who people had walked by, because we all know you should walk by beggars because they're only going to blow their money, or maybe they're faking it. And in some countries, there are professional beggars, and they're scary. A friend of mine who's a missionary in India talked about the starving woman with the little baby, and he pulled the cloak aside one day, and there was a second baby in waiting. After the first one died, got another one. Keep up the business. It happens. But you know, I got this parable in front of me. It's haunted me all my life. Got to do something with it. I look at it, it's like a mirror. I look at it, it's like a mirror. Like all parables are. So, we got Canada. We sing about Canada. We celebrate Canada. But I think we have to do Canada. We have to do Canada. We have to not let our busyness give us a hard heart. We've got to do Canada, which means we have to choose to care. And that is the rest of the story.